So we are learning Malachim Aleph. We are now starting the new Perek, Perek Hey. Last week, in Perek Dalet, which was a short chapter, discussed all of the different positions that were held in the days of Shlomo HaMelech. Now we continue in Pasuk Aleph and Perek Hey. Ushlomo Hayam Moshe B'chol HaMamlachos, and perhaps this is the connection to the previous chapter, that Shlomo had complete control over all the different places, and as we recall, he chose 12 commissioners, each one representing different tribes. So in this way, he didn't just keep all the position of power to one tribe, but rather he spread it out to all the Jewish nation. So this way there would be no jealousy, no one would think that favoritism was being had. And therefore, perhaps that's the reason why Shlomo was so successful, is one of the reasons, that he was Moshe B'chol HaMamlachos, why he was a very strong ruler over all the different places. Min HaNahar, Eretz Plishtim, from the Nahar, the river, which is in brackets in English is the Euphrates River. Eretz Plishtim, in the land of the Philistines. To the land of the Ephraim, to the Plishtim, from one side to the other, from one to the next. Yeah, and that's just how it's translated over here. The Ad Gavul Mitzrayim, until the border of Mitzrayim. Magishim Mincha V'Oibdim Eshlomo Koy Mechayav. So all of these people, in order to be able to show that they respected him and to pay homage to him, they would constantly be giving him gifts, as well as they served him all the days of his life. So we look in the Radak. The Radak begins the parak by saying, Moshe b'chol hamlachos, shayireim imenu. It wasn't because they loved him necessarily, but they were petrified of him. Gishlo mincha v'ovdim oso. And that was the reason why they served him and gave him the various gifts that we'll see in the next few sentences. The Masudas David explains, when it says Min HaNahar, which we translated in the brackets in the English as the Euphrates River, he says, Hayoytzi Min HaEden, Shehu Techilas HaMizrach. He says that this is all the way to the beginning of the eastern side, at Eretz Plishtim. So he gives us a little bit of perspective, exactly where this was located. So we find that Shlomo was a person who had, he was a melech, he ruled basically everywhere, to the point that it's brought down, not in our packet, but in the Pirkei Rabbi Elazar, he says that Shlomo, a melech, was one of, according to this interpretation, only 10 kings that ruled Misofa Olam V'ad Sofo. He ruled the entire world. It wasn't just that he ruled the Jewish people, but rather he was in charge and the king over everyone. And another reason why we're able to find this is because we know that Shlomo politically married 1,000 wives. He had a lot of wives. And he married them from different nations. We saw, at least when it came to Mitzrayim, he married the princess of the king, right, the daughter of the king. And it was all strategy in order to make sure to, on one hand, to promote peace, because if I'm married to the king's daughter, so that why are you going to fight with me? Or maybe that's precisely why you want to fight with me. But the point is that that was his motivation, to promote peace. And also, the fact that he had this connection was easier to be able to dominate and control over them. So, because of this, there was peace, as we're going to see shortly, and that he ruled this vast amount of area, which is basically encompassed the entire world. We now continue with the next puzzle.
But what does that say? Yeah. From the Euphrates, that's, how is it until Mitzrayim?
That's again, according to the interpretation of the Pirkei of Elazar, it says, Behol ha, it does, it, you're right, it mentions the places. Okay, this is before.
Well,
this is before North America was discovered, I guess, also, right? But it does say He ruled over all the kingdoms. That's not referring to the Jewish world. It's referring to all the world, right? Yeah, all the kingdoms.
China and India. And
yeah, and
Europe.
This is the...
Not really, because over here it says, the fall of Eber HaNa'ar, over the entire area beyond the Euphrates, the area west of the Euphrates, up to the Mediterranean Sea.
Right.
It sounds like more or less the good part of the Middle East that we know of.
Right. It doesn't
right.
sound like it's
at that
right.
time it was like the world.
That's it.
No, but it wasn't. You did have China and India.
Yeah, but they didn't
yeah,
know.
Yeah, but they didn't know
about it. Civilized the civilized world, the known civilized world at the time. So that's the different interpretations. He certainly was a he ruled over the kingdoms, as the Pusik says, all of the kingdoms. So even if there were kings, but he was the king of kings, and he was to the point that they used to give him gifts to show, because they were afraid of this guy. They were afraid of his position of power. But I see it's possible, you can read it, it's not so clear that he ruled over the entire world. At least the known world, where there were leaders and kings, he ruled over those nations. Pasuk Beis. Vayhi lechem shlomo liyom echad. Now, instead of us learning how much, since he was such a brilliant man, how many books he read, we want to now understand how much food he ate. Right? Vayhi lechem shlomo liyom echad. How much food was there for one day? So it makes sense because he had
wives and their makeup artists.
There you go, right.
My question is, he didn't marry these women all at one time. Did he have it over a period of time? No?
Presumably, yeah.
I know, it didn't happen like, you know, when he married a princess in Egypt, he didn't the next day marry somebody.
But if he had 1,000 wives, he was getting married
every day.
Right. Pretty much.
He was getting married often.
It says also that he wasn't so peaceful. There are a lot of enemies. He had to get married quickly.
And those were just
if he wanted to survive.
I mean, there is a halakhic discussion. Like, for example, when it came to Yaakov, who married Rachel and Leah, he had to wait a week, right? Because of Sheva Brachot. He can't just get married and then... Obviously, if you think about it, it's impossible that he did it that way.
You
can't wait one week. Right, but clearly he had to have done that. If it's 1,000.
But they didn't need
Sheva Brachot. They converted.
I hope they did.
Yeah.
Well, you can't go 4 today's halakha.
Yeah.
Yitro also converted.
It certainly is not very clear from the sentences exactly how he married all of them and exactly what happened. Only, you know, this is something which the commentators do say, that he was married to numerous people, and therefore perhaps, as you said, that's one of the reasons why he has so many mouths to feed. And precisely how much food was there? So this is what the Pasuk tells us. There was shloshim kor soles, 30 measures of kor is a type of measure of soles. Soles is translated in Mesudas David as kemach naki bioser, very clean flour. So it's a very refined flour. Vishishim kor kama. And when it came to the kemach, which is not as refined, that was 60 kor. So it's a little bit, it was double the amount, probably because it was less expensive. But that's how much it was, which is a fabulous amount of food. And we'll see exactly how much that is in a second. We'll see Pasuk Gimel. Asara Bakar, every day, there was Asara Bakar, 10 oxen. Bri'im is translated in the Mesudas Sion as Shemenim, that they were fatty, right. The Esrim Bakar Re'i, and 20 oxen, which were Re'i, which is translated in the Mesudas Sion as Ra'im Bimara, that they were grazing in the fields, in the pastures. So not that they were actually fattened, but they naturally ate. Umeyatzon, and 100 sheep. Okay. Levad, that's not even to include the Ayosvi, when it came to the other things, such as the gazelle and the deer, v'yachmor, v'arvurim, avusin, and the yachmor, and the other thing, which is called the Vavarim Avusim, in which the Rashi translates as Yesh Rabbo Seinu Omrim, which is quoting the Gemara in Bava Metzia, that some of the rabbis interpret is referring to Tarnagolim Petumin, which are fattened or stuffed fowl.
Barbara,
they
were organic, but they were
forced. Barbara, right.
All organic. No, no
whole
ones.
But they didn't have it.
Thank God.
So this is what he provided, as Mesudas David says in Pasuk Beis, Lechem Shlomo, L'chol HaBa'al Shulchano. This gives us a little bit of an insight as to what was going on. And Mesudas David in Pasuk Beis says that the food that he had, but it only mentions the bread, it only mentions the meat, but nonetheless, he had this, says Mesudas David, L'chol haba el shulchano, anyone that would come to his table, and which teaches us a very interesting thing, the way that the English on page 41 frames, I underlined it, says, alternatively, he needed all this food because he had a flood of visitors from the many peoples who were in his sphere of influence, and the others who had great respect for him, which is how the Mesudas David interprets the reason why he had all this. Now, how much was it? So we look at, again in the English, that which I underlined, it says the following. To feed the huge numbers of people comprising his own court, plus the large number of foreign visitors, Shlomo required an enormous amount of food. The Abarbanel estimates that there was enough food on this list to feed 60,000 people. Okay, that's quite a bit. Fine flour was used to prepare meals for the senior members of the court, which I guess it was more difficult for them to be able to digest, and the distinguished visitors. Ordinary flour was used for the others. There are differing opinions regarding the volume of a core. Accordingly, the 90 core mentioned here, which was 1630, were as little as 653 bushels, or as much as 1,161 bushels. An enormous, enormous amount of food. So, on one level, because of his family, but it's also another political move. And the political move was to be able to get people to realize, you know what, you want a feast, you want a free meal, you can come anytime you want. And the advantage of doing that is if you're going to have
an open house.
An open house. And the great thing about it is if you have a bunch of enemies, you could do it was L'shem Shemayim, right? Or for a good political move, because if you have a bunch of neighboring countries that could rebel or try to attack you, but yet you always invite them and they can come to the palace and eat, it's kind of difficult for you to attack your enemy when your full stomach is because of the food that they provided you. So perhaps this was a motivation for Shlomo, how he was able to keep the peace. Right, that's one. That's how the Mi'am always explains this, actually.
Clearly, there was no unemployment.
Why? Because how was he able to get all this stuff?
And the feeding, and the taking care of the fields. It's agricultural. It's all agricultural. So you need a lot of people to work.
And you needed a lot of food to feed all the visitors. Also.
All of it, right. So, now, again, one of the things that we mentioned is where did he get this? So this was the burden of all the different people that we spoke about last week, that there were 12 different commissioners that were responsible, that each one had a certain territory that they had jurisdiction over, and they collected this stuff to the gift to the palace. So you knew 1 month out of the year, you're going to, basically everything that you have is going to be shipped over to the king. And it was done evenly, so as not again to cause any jealousy or anger. So that's what happened. Now, there is an interesting reason, which is said in the Gemara in Bava Metzia on Pei Vav, that says another reason for why there was so much food. And I'm just going to read it. It's not in our packet, but it's only a few lines. In the name of Rabbi Yitzchak, he says, the Elef Nashim Hayu L'Shlomo. This is the Gemara. He had Elef Nashim, 1,000 wives. That's what's brought down in the Talmud. Okay? I don't know how they came up with that number, but exactly 1,000, not 999, not 1,001, 1,000 wives. Kol achas v'achas asaslo besa kach. Apparently, according to this reading, it wasn't necessarily that all these people were preparing this food for Shlomo and all these guests, but it was actually each wife made a huge amount of food. All 1,000 of them did every single day. And all 1,000 together equaled all this huge amount. So why did they make this huge, huge meal for their husband? My taima, isha zus smura, because one woman thought, shema etzli soid hayom. Zos smura, shema etzli soid hayom. Each one thought, maybe today will be the day my husband will come and eat dinner with me. So every single night, these women made a beautiful meal. And a candlelit dinner. And unfortunately, 999 of them were disappointed every single time. It doesn't really get into that so much, at least at this point. I guess we'll see as the prakim unfold. But I know the commentators do say that he did not have children proportionate to the amount of wives, which means he did not have a lot of children. He should have perhaps had more. Or they're just not known, and therefore not much mention is found about them.
How was he able to have so many children if there was a prohibition against having excessive wives and horses?
Well, that was his problem.
Well, I mean, he did have a lot of wives. So. He ultimately, as we're going to see, thinking that because he was so wise, which got the best of him, he thought the ruling did not apply to him. He thought that would only apply to someone who was not so... Yeah, he did it with Shem Shemayim to keep the peace, to help build the base of Mikdash, which has to be in a time where there's not war. And he was hoping that everything would be okay.
And he's going to try to bring all these women over to Yiddishkeit, no?
Yeah, so it's Kiruv.
Just in one word,
Kiruv.
I think to say about it.
Well,
he had no Jewish wives.
Well, the commentators, at least when it talks about the wife of who was from Egypt, the commentators do say that she certainly did convert. That's clear. That's at the beginning of the third parak. So certainly we're not going to say that he intermarried. That we're not going to have the audacity to say. He certainly married them after they had converted.
Yeah. How did they make peace with the fact that he built the shin for his wives?
How they what?
He built temples for his wives.
So they're converted. How could they do that?
How could he, who bringing the Beit HaMikdash, build those mikdashim?
You know, idol worship, you're saying?
Mm-hmm. Of course.
Mm-hmm. Especially if they were supposed to have converted.
Well, that was the mistake, was that he thought that they would not go astray. He thought that perhaps he would, together with the environment, they would be able to remain devoted to their Jewish faith.
But he, at the same time, encouraged temples for idol worshiping.
Is that really?
We'll have to see when we get to the downfall of the women, how they went astray. We don't see that. We're not up to that point yet. But when we do, I guess we'll have to save some for the sequel. We don't want to jump too far ahead. Anyway, so that's an interpretation exactly as to why he had all these things. It was really the wives that had all this prepared. Now, some of the commentators also make an interesting observation, as opposed to, as we're getting close to Purim, when it came to Purim, the Achashverosh, when he threw a party, there was one thing that he had, which is missing on the list of all the things that Shlomo had, namely wine. There was no. You see, at this party, the Me'am always points out in the sentences there was no wine. He had a lot of good food. He had a lot of bread. He had that staple, and he had meat. So he had a lot of good food. There's no mention about wine. And certainly if there would have been wine, it would have been mentioned. That's how the Mamloys interprets it. And this is interpreted that it's to Shlomo's credit, that he was a person that wanted to make sure that another reason for this, by bringing people to his palace, similar to Hafnasas Arachim, bringing someone who maybe is not so knowledgeable or observant into your home, then you can educate them, you can engage them in a conversation, teach them about religion and spirituality. And he was concerned by the temptations of alcohol, that a person would be drinking wine, then they would not necessarily be with their senses to be able to truly comprehend all the beauty that Judaism has to offer. So that's how the Mian Lois interprets the contrasting the party of Ahasuerus to Shlomo in his reign as a king. He would not serve wine, and he did this in order to get people to be engaged in learning and the like. Okay, now it's also noteworthy before we continue with the next pasuk that we have to remember, and we're going to see this eventually in Rashi and Pasuk Beis, that Shlomo was not only a king, but he was also an author. He was an author of a bestseller known as Koheles, Ecclesiastes. Right? It was on the New York bestsellers for many months. And Shir Shirim as well, correct. But I want just to that we're going to see in the Rashi in a short one, maybe next time in Pasuk Beis. But regardless, Koheles talks about Hakol Hevel. And he talks about, if you recall, all the things that he has, all the enormous amount of wealth and the material connection that he has in this world. And if you read these sentences, as we just did, it gives us a little bit of perspective as to how he, of all people, has the right to be able to make that statement, because if a person who has nothing, you're living in a little shack and you're in poverty, so how can you say, Hakol Hevel? I mean, you don't have anything to be able to know what it's like. He had everything. As you can see, the mass amount of food and the wives, and we're going to see in Pasuk Vav in a moment, the horses, he had everything you can possibly imagine. For someone like that, he could be the author of Koheles to talk about that which is vanity, that which is Hevel. So let's move on now to the next question.
People came to him for his opinions, for advice.
He's a very wise person. We're going to see how wise he is compared to others. Could be also right. He had a lot of people for that reason as well.
That makes sense that people would come from all over the world.
Right.
His opinion and knowledge.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And again, also because they were scared of him and they wanted to make sure that he wouldn't attack them. As the redox.
That would be if they came for his wisdom, that would be respect, not so much fear.
You're right. It's true. I mean, the redox does mention Shayu Reim Imenu. They were afraid. But you're right, there probably were certainly other motivations as well, including gleaning from his knowledge.
Makat Shva would not be afraid of him.
Right.
But she would come Makat Shva. But she would come for respect.
Right. So it's certainly...
He might have been an Elvis Presley kind of a figure for wisdom.
Right. That's true. So that's probably, again, it's probably mixed motivations, depending on who the person is. But nonetheless, people did come from near and far. Pasuk Dalet. Ki rodem b'chol eiver ha-nahar. Roda is translated as Sudasion is Moshe. Again, he ruled over.
Meret.
It's if you in fact the Mesudas Sion helps you out and quotes a pasuk in Tehillim. It says Moshe Kamo Roda Bekerav Oyvecha, that I ruled in the midst of my adversaries. That's how pasuk in Kapitel Kuf Yud in Tehillim brings down. So anyway, so he was ruling B'chol Eiver HaNahar. So he was ruling over the entire area on the other side of the river. And again, that's translated again as the Euphrates in English. Mit Tifsach v'ad Aza. From Tifsach until Aza, which is questionable whether or not that's really from one side to the other. Or some interpret Tifsach and Aza were actually next to one another, which we'll discuss in a second. So I'll tell you right now, Tifsach until Aza, the Gemara in Megillah actually says that, like, for example, in Kitta Ahasuerus, he ruled from Hodu until Cush. That's the first sentence in Megillah's Esther, that he was ruled 120 provinces, Mihodu bad Cush. So the Gemara says that, according to one interpretation, they actually either... it was from one side to the other, or Hodu and Cush were right next to one another. And it says that just Hodu and Kush were neighboring cities. It's a dispute. They translated.
And Kush is
Ethiopia. Ethiopia to India. That's how it's loosely translated. But it's not necessarily the case. The Talmud says possibly they were next to one another. An interpretation. And they say that just as. So what does that mean? He ruled from there to there. It's like from. I ruled all the way from Bell Harbor to the Ponset. So what does that mean? Right? Well, yeah, maybe.
I wouldn't mind.
So he said that just as Ahasuerus was able to control these two cities because they were so close to one another, he also was able to rule everywhere else the same way. That's the how it's interpreted. So the same thing, the Gemara says, when it came to Shlomo, that he ruled from Tifsach until Aza. Either there were two opposite sides, or they were next to one another, neighboring communities, cities, and that just as he was able to rule over them because they were so close to one another, so too he had control over places in the same way. So it's not just when the king is there, it's like the like on the fiddle of the roof, they ask what is a bracha for the czar. And the blessing was he should be far away from me, right. So which means when he's far away, so he doesn't really have any power. So that wasn't the case with Shlomo. He had complete control as though, even if he was far away, as though he was right there. That's how the Gemara interprets it. As well as Ahasuerus had that same control. B'chol Malchei Eber HaNahar. So he ruled over in this entire area, which, as again, we discussed, all the way beyond this river, again, the Euphrates, according to the English on the page 41. B'shalom Hayolo Mikol Avarav Misaviv. And there was peace. Mikol Avarav, the Masudas Sion says, Mikol Stadav, on all sides. Misaviv, no matter which way you go, in any direction, there was continual peace. So, as you can imagine, if there would be more than one king, then there's going to be a conflict, there's going to be a power struggle. But if you have one leader, and it's definitive, and everyone knows this is the leader, then there's no power struggle anymore, because he's going to be someone that's in complete control, and no one's going to contest that level of control. Now, even though it does mention that he was in complete control, there is a Gemara, which is lengthy, I'm just going to say it outside, that says that Shlomo initially ruled the entire world, as we interpret it according to one explanation, but unfortunately, he ended up losing this level of power. At this point, he was perhaps on the top of his game, because he did rule over all the ground, over the land. The truth is, the Gemara says that initially he also had control over the Elyonim, which are the upper spheres, the angels and things like that, which now he lost. And they say because he became so materialistic, he lost that spiritual connection. He wasn't as in tune. And therefore now he rules over the land. And then it ends up saying, afterwards, he keeps losing power, as we're going to see throughout. We see in Koheles, he said, Ani Koheles, Hayisi Melech al Yisrael. I was a king over Yisrael. Which means that at a certain point, he lost the control over the entire world, and he was only king over the Jewish people. And then also it says in Koheles, Divrei Koheles ben David Melech Yerushalayim. Which means that at one point afterwards, he was not in control over the entire Jewish people, and ended up only over Yerushalayim. And it ends up saying, ultimately, he ends up only having being a melech over himself. That he only became a melech, a king, over his walking stick, over his staff, and that was it. And therefore, he ends up being diminished or losing this power that he. Once had. Okay.
Did they explain how he got new horses in such a short time?
That I don't know, but well, let's try to get to that. So let's see the next pasuk. Pasuk Kai. Let's at least see a couple more pasuk. Be'yeshiv Yehuda v'Yisrael levetach. So the Jewish people were sitting in peace and tranquility. Ish tachas gafno v'tachas te'inoso. I'm not sure. Maybe what is the reason? Very difficult to understand. Why do we need to know where they were sitting under? They were sitting under these grapevines and underneath a te'ena, underneath my figs, right? Midan v'ad be'er shava, all the way from Dan, all the way down to Be'er Shava. So some people explain this shows the safety that they had. Because if you were concerned that you would have an enemy, then what would you do? You build a moat, you have this huge fortified city, and then I'll be able to be safe. I'm safe because I have this huge tower that's protecting me. But what do? They sat underneath trees. So they needed trees for shelter, for shade, but pretty easy to attack you if you're just underneath a tree.
But it's also a symbol of wealth and wealth, because of this brains, it's an answer
right.
to prayer.
Right. Correct. Yeah. So it could represent their affluence, and perhaps that's the reason why it mentions it. It says, even though all this food is being given out, they still were able to sit down and relax. They weren't.
Prosperity and peace. I think it's interesting that they mentioned these two places, so it gives you a feeling in mind. Are these the boundaries at that time when you start Israel?
It would be very interesting to have a map. Unfortunately didn't help me out with that either. The question is, was there anyone in Eilat scuba diving at the time? I'm not sure. But it's all Be'er Sheva. Okay. Vayihi Shlomo arboim elef urvo susim lemerkavo. And Rashi discusses exactly what this means, the actual amounts, but needless to say, there was a tremendous amount of horses that Shlomo had, or Boim Elef, 40,000 Aruva Susim, stalls of horses, Lamer Kavo, for his chariots, Ushneim Aser Elef, and 12,000 Parashim, 12,000 horsemen. So exactly how many horses does that equal? Certainly the answer is a lot, right? And obviously the problem with all of this is, how could he do such a thing? How is he allowed to violate that which the Torah says? If you look in the Radak, which I underlined, which is the second wide line, the Amru Chachamim Zal, our sages tell us, Ki Avar, that Shlomo violated a clear negative prohibition in the Torah about a king, lo yarbo lo susim. They're not allowed to have too many horses. Pirshu, an interpretation, was lo yarbo lo susim batalim. They shouldn't have a bunch of horses just sitting around doing nothing. And since he had 12,000 horsemen, the hoylo arboim elef arbo susim, I'm not sure why he writes it in the opposite order, and he had 40,000 stalls for his horses, Harvey Susan Batalum Hoylo. Obviously there was a lot of horses that were just horsing around, doing nothing. Umasha Harvey Shlomo Susim. So it's on one hand, by the way, this also answers another question which we're gonna see. That's why we needed so much food. It wasn't just for the people, some say also for all the animals he had. You have to feed all these animals. So we're gonna see that in another commentary another time. Masha Harvey Shlomo Susim Prussian, why do you have so many of these horses and chariots and as well as horsemen? Vahu Lohayisolo Shumochama didn't have any war. Lo Asa El Kavod Gdula. He did this for honor, to be able to show power. Kadeshi Yelchu Imo Kishihu Makamakam. In order that he should be able to go from one place to the next. There used to be, maybe there was a couple minor wars, so he needed them. So just focusing for a second on what the Radak said, one possible interpretation, Mam always echoes this, is that he needed an efficient transportation system. And therefore he looked at these horses, not just that they were sitting in a barn doing nothing, but because there were so many people going and coming back in this hub, the central place, he needed to have, before there were trains, he had all these horses coming in different places. So because of that, That's the reason why he had to have a lot of.
They weren't all for his use.
That's what it's. That's how this is interpreted. Or maybe it was for him to go to different places. But some interpret it that it was just a way for people to freely come back and forth to the palace.
It seems to me they needed more parking places for the horses because of the people who were coming to him.
Right.
Than parked horses.
Right. I guess he had probably had meters and stuff.
I think the number six has underlined on it.
Yes.
It gives a really clear idea of Talmud's interpretation.
Go ahead. Oh, okay, so on page 41, it says that Egypt was the primary supplier of horses in those days. The issue, the Torah says explicitly, which is not found in the Radak, is the problem that by having too many horses, you're going to end up going back to Egypt. And there's a prohibition to go back to Egypt, even though the Rambam, others did it, that's a whole other discussion, unless they were necessary. Shlomo relied on his wisdom and good judgment, saying, quote, I will have many horses without returning the people to Egypt. In the end, he was proven wrong, for he did have to return to Egypt for his supply of horses. The sages cite this as an example, a fallacy of thinking that one is wiser than the Torah. The Bar Manel suggests that Shlomo rationalized that he was acting appropriately in amassing horses because he did it to enhance national security. This was before he didn't ask people to take off their shoes. Instead, he had them... He had a lot of horses. So, what do you mean? There's no wars, but maybe that's precisely why there was no wars. Right? Because there was all these heavy horses as a deterrent against potential enemies. Right, as a deterrent. Although Shlomo was at peace with the neighboring countries, this may have been precisely because he had such an immense cavalry that other countries avoided confrontations with him. So going back, yeah, they realized that it was just a massive, just waiting people, and they were just waiting to do something with these horses, and therefore they're just sitting there doing nothing, but as a form of protection.
Go back to the old story of, you know, Samaya Al-Hashem. Does this right. show that you really...
Right. That's the problem, is the question. That's the question. That's the question. Is there, where do we find the hishtadlus and too much?
The horses and then the whole like iron, is that going to save you?
Depending on the shape.
Right. And this I guess, was his struggle. This was his journey throughout his life to be able to get to that point ultimately in Koheles.